Chapter 2. To see that your life is a story while you're in the middle of living it may be a help to living it well. It's unwise, though, to think you know how it's going to go or how it's going to end. That's to be known only when it's over. And even when it's over, even when it's somebody else's life, somebody who lived 100 years ago, whose story I've heard told time and again, while I'm hearing it, I hope and fear as if I didn't know how it would end. And so I live the story, and it lives in me. That's as good a way as I know to outwit death. Stories are what death thinks he puts an end to. He can't understand that they end in him, but they don't end with him. Other people's stories may become part of your own, the foundation of it, the ground it goes on. So it was with my father's story of the blind Branter, in his story of the raid on Dunnet, and my mother's stories of the lowlands and of the time when Cumberlow was king. When I think of my childhood, I enter into the hall of the stone house. I am in the hearth seat, in the muddy courtyard or the clean stables of Caspermont. I am in the kitchen garden with my mother picking beans, or with her by the hearth in the round tower room. I am out on the open hills with Gry. I am in the world of the never-ending stories. A great thick staff of yew wood, crudely cut but polished black at the grip by long use, hung beside the door of the stone house, in the dark entryway. Blind Caddard's staff. It was not to be touched. It was much taller than I was when I first knew that. I used to go and touch it secretly for the thrill of it, because it was forbidden, because it was a mystery. I thought Branter Caddard had been my father's father, for that was as far back in history as my understanding went. I knew my grandfather's name had been Orrick. I was named for him. So, in my mind, my father had two fathers. I had no difficulty with that, but found it interesting. I was in the stables with my father looking after the horses. He didn't fully trust any of his people with his horses, and had begun training me to help him with them when I was 3. I was up on a step stool currying the winter hair out of the roan mare's coat. I asked my father, who was working on the big gray stallion in the next stall, "Why did you only name me for one of your fathers?" "I had only one to name you for," my father said, "like most respectable folk." He did not often laugh, but I could see his dry smile. "Then who was Branter Caddard?" But then I had figured it out before he could answer. "He was your father's father, my father's 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 father," Cannock said. Through the cloud of winter fur and dust and dried mud he was bringing up out of Greylag's coat, I kept tugging and whacking and combing away at the mare's flank, and was rewarded with rubbish in my eyes and nose and mouth, and a patch of bright white and red spring coat the size of my hand on Roni's flank, and a rumble of contentment from her. She was like a cat. If you petted her, she leaned on you. I pushed her off as hard as I could and worked on, trying to enlarge the bright patch. There were too many fathers for me to keep straight. The one I had came around to the front of the mare's stall, wiping his face, and stood there watching me. I worked away, showing off, pushing the curry comb now in strokes too long to do much good. But my father didn't say anything about it. He said, "Caddard had the greatest gift of our lineage, or any other of the Western Hills, the greatest that was ever given us. What is the gift of our lineage, Orrick?" I stopped work, stepped down from the stool carefully, because it was a long step down for me, and stood facing my father. When he said my name, I stood up, stood still and faced him, so I had done as far back as I could remember. "Our gift is the undoing," I said. He nodded. He was always gentle with me. I had no fear of harm from him. Obeying him was a difficult, intense pleasure. His satisfaction was my reward. "What does that mean?" I said as he had taught me to say. "It means the power to undo, unmake, destroy." Have you seen me use that power? I saw you make a bowl go all to pieces. Have you seen me use that power on a living thing? I saw you make a willow wand go all soft and black. I hoped he would stop, but that was no longer where these questions stopped. Have you seen me use that power on a living animal? I saw you make a rat die. How did it die? His voice was quiet and relentless. It was in the winter, in the courtyard, a trapped rat, a young rat. It had got into a rain barrel and been unable to clamber out. Dara the sweeper saw it first. My father said, "Come here, Oryk." And I came, and he said, "Be still and see this." And I stood still and watched. I craned my neck so that I could see the rat swimming in the water that half filled the barrel. My father stood above the barrel, gazing down steadily into it. He moved his hand, his left hand, and said something or breathed sharply out. The rat squirmed once, shuddered, and floated on the water. My father reached his right hand in and brought it out. It lay utterly limp in his hand, shapeless, like a wet rag, not like a rat. But I saw the tail and toes with their tiny claws. "Touch it, Oryk," he said. I touched it. It was soft, without bones, like a little half-filled sack of meal inside its thin, wet skin. "It is unmade," my father said, his eyes on mine, and I was afraid of his eyes then. "You unmade it," I said now, in the stable, with a dry mouth, afraid of my father's eyes. He nodded. "I have that power," he said, "as you will. And as it grows in you, I'll teach you the way to use it." "What is the way to use your gift?" "With eye and hand and breath and will," I said, as he had taught me. He nodded, satisfied. I relaxed a little, but he did not. The test was not over. "Look at that knot of hair, Oryk," he said. A little clotted tangle of muddy horsehair lay on the stable floor near my feet, among the slight littering of straw. It had been caught in the roan mare's mane, and I had worked it free and let it drop. At first I thought my father was going to scold me for dirtying the stable floor. "Look at it. At it only. Don't look away from it. Keep your eyes on it." I obeyed. "Move your hand so." Coming behind me, my father moved my left arm and hand gently, carefully, till the joined fingers pointed at the clot of mud and hair. "Hold it so. Now say what I say after me. With your breath, but not your voice. Say this." He whispered something that had no meaning to me, and I whispered it after him, holding my hand pointing as he had placed it, staring and staring at the clot of hair. For a moment nothing moved. Everything held still. Then Roni sighed and shifted her feet, and I heard the wind gusting outside the stable door, and the tangle of muddy hair on the floor moved a little. "It moved!" I cried. "The wind moved it," my father said. His voice was mild, with a smile in it. He stood differently, stretched his shoulders. "Wait a while. You're not 6 yet." "You do it, father," I said, staring at the clod of horsehair, excited and angry, vindictive. "You unmake it." I scarcely saw him move or heard his breath. The tangled thing on the floor uncurled in a puff of dust, and nothing lay there but a few long, reddish-cream hairs. "The power will come to you," Canuck said. "The gift is strong in our lineage, but in Kadard, it was strongest. Sit down here. You're old enough to know his story." I sat perched on the step stool. My father stood in the doorway of the stall, a thin, straight, dark man, bare-legged in his heavy black Uplander kilt and coat, his eyes dark and bright through the mask of stable dirt on his face. His hands were filthy, too. But they were strong, fine hands, steady, without restlessness. His voice was quiet. His will was strong. He told me the story of blind Kadard. Kadard showed his gift earlier than any son of our lineage, or any but the greatest families of the Carantages. At 3, he'd gaze at his toys and they'd fall to pieces, and he could untie a knot with a look. At 4, he used his power against a dog that leapt on him and frightened him, and destroyed it, as I destroyed that rat. He paused for my nod of acknowledgement. The servants were afraid of him, and his mother said, "While his will is a child's will, he is a danger to us all, even to me." She was a woman of our lineage. She and her husband, Oryk, were cousins. He heeded her warning. They tied a bandage around the child's eyes for 3 years so that he couldn't use the power of the eye. All that time they taught and trained him, as I teach you and train you. He learned well. His reward for perfect obedience was to see again, and he was careful, using his great gift only in practice, on things of no use or value. Only twice in his youth did he show his power. Once, when the Brantor of Drummond had been raiding cattle from one domain and another, they invited him to Caspermont and let him see Kadard, who was a boy of 12 then, unmake a flight of wild geese. With one glance and gesture, he dropped them from the sky. He did this smilingly, as if to entertain their visitor. "A keen eye," Drum said. And he stole none of our cattle. Then when Kadard was 17, a war party came down from the Carantages, led by the Brantor of Tibramont. They were after men and women to work new fields they'd cleared. Our people came running here to the stone house for protection, fearing to be taken under the rain, made to follow that Brantor and die toiling for him with no will but his left to them. Kadard's father Oryk hoped to withstand the raid here in the stone house, but Kadard, not telling him what he planned, went out alone. Keeping to the edge of the forest, he spied out one Highlander and then another, and as he saw them, he unmade them. I saw the rat, the soft sack of skin. He let the other Highlanders find those bodies. Then, carrying the parley flag, he came out on the hillside, facing the long cairn, alone. He called to the raiders. "I have done this across a mile of distance and farther." He called to them over the valley as they stood up there behind the great rocks of the cairn. "The rocks do not hide you from me." And he destroyed a standing stone of the cairn. The Brantor of Tibramont had taken shelter behind it. It shattered and fell into chips and dust. "My eye is strong," Kadard said. He waited for them to answer. Tibro said, "Your eye is strong, Caspro." Kadard said, "Do you come here seeking servants?" The other said, "We need men, yes." Kadard said, "I will give you 2 of our people to work for you, but as servants, not under the rain." The Brantor said, "You are generous. We will take your gift and keep your terms." Kadard came back here to the house and called out 2 young serfs from different farms of our domain. He took them to the Highlanders and gave them over to them. Then he said to Tibro, "Go back to your highlands now, and I will not follow." They went, and since that day they have never come raiding from the Carantages as far west as our domain. So Kadard Strong Eye was the talk of all the uplands. He stopped to let me think about what I'd heard. After a while, I looked up at him to see if I could ask a question. It seemed to be all right, so I asked what I wanted to know. "Did the young men from our domain want to go to Tibramont?" "No," my father said. "And Kadard didn't want to send them to serve another master, or lose their labor here. But if power is shown, a gift must be offered. That is important. Remember it." tell me what I said. It's important, if you show your power, to offer a gift too. My father nodded approval. The gift's gift, he said, low and dry. So then, a while after that, old Oryk went with his wife and some of his people to our high farms, leaving the stone house to his son Kadard, who was the Brantern now. And the domain prospered. We ran 1,000 sheep in those days, they say, on the stony hills, and our white oxen were famous. Men came up from Dunnet and Danner back then to bargain for our cattle. Kadard married a woman of the Barris of Drummond, Semadan, in a great wedding. Drum had wanted her for his own son, but Semadan refused him, for all his wealth, and married Kadard. People came to that wedding from all the domains of the West. Kennick paused. He slapped the roan mare's rump as she switched her snarled tail at him. She shuffled, nudging against me, wanting me to get back to combing the tangles out of her. Semadan had the gift of her lineage. She went on the hunt with Kadard and called the deer and elk and wild swine to him. They had a daughter, Asal, and a son, Kanak. And all went well, but after some years there came a bad winter and a cold, dry summer, with little grass for the flocks. Crops failed. A plague came among our white cattle. All the finest stock died in a single season. There was sickness among the people of the domain, too. Semadan bore a dead child and was ill for a long time after. The drought went on a year, another year. Everything went badly. But Kadard could do nothing. These were not matters in his power. So he lived in rage. I watched my father's face. Grief, dismay, anger swept over it as he told of them. His bright eyes saw only what he told. Our misfortune made the people of Drummond grow insolent, and they came raiding and thieving here. They stole a good horse from our west pastures. Kadard went after the horse thieves and found them halfway home to Drummond. In his heat and fury, he did not control his power, but destroyed them all. 6 men. One of them was a nephew of the Brantor of Drummond. Drum could not ask bloodright, for the men had been thieving. They had the stolen horse with them. But it left a greater hatred between our domains. After that, people went in fear of Kadard's temper. When a dog disobeyed him, he unmade it. If he missed his shot hunting, he'd destroy all the thickets that hid the game, leaving them black and ruined. A shepherd spoke some insolence to him up on the high pastures, and in his anger, Kadard withered the man's arm and hand. Children ran from his shadow now. Bad times breed quarrels. Kadard bade his wife come call to the hunt for him. She refused, saying she was not well. He ordered her. Come, I must hunt, there is no meat in the house. She said, Go hunt then, I will not come. And she turned away with a serving maid she was fond of, a girl of 12 who helped her with her children. Then, in a rage of anger, Kadard came in front of them, saying, Do what I say! And with eye, hand, breath, and will, he struck the girl. She sank down there, destroyed, unmade. Semadan cried out and knelt over her and saw she was dead. Then she stood up from the body and faced Kadard. Did you not dare strike me? She said, scorning him. And in his fury, he struck her down. The people of the house stood and saw all this. The children cried out and tried to come to their mother, weeping, and the women held them back. Then Kadard went out of the hall, to his wife's room, and no one dared follow him. When he knew what he had done, he knew what he must do. He could not trust his strength to control his gift. Therefore he blinded his eyes. The first time Kanak told me that story, he did not say how Kadard blinded himself. I was too young, too scared and bewildered already by this terrible history, to ask or wonder. Later on, when I was older, I asked if Kadrd used his dagger. No, Canuck said. He used his gift to undo his gift. Among Samadan's things was a glass mirror in a silver frame shaped like a leaping salmon. The merchants that used to venture up from Dunnet and Danner to bargain for cattle and woolen goods sometimes brought such rare toys and fancies. In the first year of the marriage, Kadrd had traded a white bull for the mirror to give to his young wife. He took it in his hand now and looked into it. He saw his own eyes. With hand and breath and will, he struck them with the power in them. The glass shattered, and he was blind. No one sought bloodright against him for the murder of his wife and the girl. Blind as he was, he served as Brantor of Caspermont till he had trained his son Canuck in the use of his power. Then Canuck became Brantor, and blind Kadrd went up to the high farms, where he lived among the cattle herders till he died. I didn't like all this sad and fearful ending of the story. The first time I heard it, I soon put most of it out of my mind. What I liked was the first part, about the boy with a mighty gift who could frighten his own mother, and the brave youth defying the enemy and saving his domain. When I went out alone on the open hills, I was Kadrd Strongeye. 100 times I summoned the terrified Highlanders and called, "I have done this across a mile of distance," and shattered the boulder they hid behind, and sent them crawling home. I remembered how my father had held and positioned my left hand, and time and again I stood staring with all my eyes at a rock, and held my hand so, in just that way. But I couldn't recall the word he had whispered to me, if it had been a word. "With the breath, not the voice," he had said. I could almost remember it, yet I couldn't hear the sound of it or feel how my lips and tongue had formed it, if they had formed it. Time and again I almost said it, but said nothing. Then, impatient, I hissed some meaningless sound and pretended that the rock moved, shattered, dropped into dust and fragments, and the Highlanders cowered before me as I said, "My eye is strong." I would go look at the boulder then, and once or twice I was sure there was a chip or a crack in it that had not been there before. Sometimes, when I had been Kadrd Strongeye long enough, I became one of the farm boys he gave to the Highlanders. I escaped from them by clever ruses and woodcraft, and eluded pursuit, and led my pursuers into the bogs I knew and they didn't know, and so came back to Caspermont. Why a serf would want to return to servitude at Caspermont, having escaped it at Tibramont, I didn't know. I never thought to ask. In all likelihood, that is what such a boy would do. He would come home. Our farm people and herders were about as well off as we in the Stonehouse were. Our fortunes were won. It wasn't fear of our powers that kept them with us, generation after generation. Our powers protected them. What they feared was what they didn't know. What they clung to was what they knew. I know where I'd go if I were carried off by enemies and escaped. I knew there was nowhere in all the uplands, or in the broad, bright, lower world my mother told me of, that I would ever love, as I loved the bare hills and thin woods, the rocks and bogs of Caspermont. I know it still.